Thank you very, very much, everyone. It's really a great honor to be with you. I didn't think I would be saying a tremendous accomplishment to get here, but it is very serious what took place at the border. It's very serious what took place at the border on November 25th at 6 o'clock. We just thought it would be routine, hand in your passports as you cross the border, and we were heading to the talk at the Vancouver Public Library. And once they had our passports, they told us to pull over. We had to go into the facility, and it was there that they started to ask me this series of questions. First, they said, "We want your notes on your speech tonight," which I was shocked by. But we were already now late for the talk. They ended up holding us for well over an hour. And I went out to the car, and I picked up the book, and I brought it inside. And I handed it to the guard and said, "I'll be reading columns from the book." And he said, "I want your notes." I said, "Well, I really speak extemporaneously. But it'll be the basis of my talk." Actually, I said I begin with the last column, which is about Tommy Douglas, the premier of Saskatchewan. We were at the Douglas Crossing, by the way. They insisted there was no connection. But I said I'd be talking about Tommy Douglas, the premier of Saskatchewan, because he is considered one of the greatest Canadians and pioneered the whole universal health care, Medicare that we have here. He also happens to be, but we'll talk about that in a second, related to a famous actor in the United States. And, but he wasn't interested in any of that. He said, "What else are you going to be talking about?" So I said, "Well, the whole health care reform debate in the United States, what else are you going to be talking about?" "Well, global warming. What else are you going to be talking about?" "The global economic meltdown. What else are you going to be talking about?" "The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. What else are you going to be talking about?" I said, "Well, that pretty much does it." And he said, "Are you going to be talking about the Olympics?" And I said, You know, I don't live here. I did not exactly know what he was referring to. I thought he was talking about, and I said, "Do you mean when President Obama went to Copenhagen to push for the Olympics to come to Chicago?" And he said, "No, you didn't even get them, the Olympics in Chicago." So I said, "I know." And he said, "I'm talking about the Olympics here in 2010. And I said, I didn't want to insult him, but I said, "No, I wasn't planning to talk about your Olympics." And he said, "You're saying you're not talking about the Olympics?" He clearly didn't believe me. "Do you all just constantly talk about the Olympics?" But it definitely piqued my interest, because he is seriously concerned. And I said, "That was not what I was planning to talk about." He was taking notes while I was speaking on a piece of paper, and his coworker, another guard, they're all armed, was inputting everything into a computer. And when the fellow guard wasn't inputting things into a computer, he was reading the book, which I think could have a good effect. But he was reading the columns. Then they said that I had to follow them. Then they went out to the car and they started rifling through all of our documents, everything in the car. They opened my colleague's computer. They opened Dennis's computer. They were going, when I went out, one of the computers were open and he was going through it, and he told me to get back inside. I saw them going through our bags. When Dennis came out and opened his computer, it was in his email. It's a serious violation. Then we were continuing to wait later and later, had called the Vancouver Public Library. And when they came back in, they told me to follow them into a back room. I did, and they took my picture, and they made 4 copies of the picture. They said they were going to use it for a document they were giving. I said, I don't understand. I didn't think we need a visa to come into Canada from the United States. And they said this would be a control document that they would give us. And they took pictures of Dennis and Chuck and put the pictures into this document, this control document. And when we opened the document, they stapled it to our passport. It said that we had to leave by tomorrow at midnight. We had to leave Canada by tomorrow at midnight. I thought you all felt that people coming to Canada was a good thing, especially with his major concern about the Olympics. But it said we have to leave by midnight tomorrow and that we have to check in with the authorities when we leave. This is very serious. There's supposed to be a separation of the press and the state. That's what makes a democracy healthy. We are supposed to be a check and balance on power, and they're not supposed to be checking our documents. They're not supposed to be, I don't mean our passport, but our notes, our computers. They're not supposed to be rifling through them. It's not only a violation of freedom of the press, but it's a violation of your right to know. Because if journalists fear that they're going to be monitored, that they're going to be surveilled, that they're going to be detained, it's more difficult and they'll be more afraid to get out information. And that is a disservice to a democratic society. It means the information you won't have. And information is power. It empowers you to make informed decisions about critical issues and enables you to have debates that lead to public policy, that lead to the conduct of your country. It was a very serious violation. I am still really very troubled, to say the least, about what happened, stunned by what happened on the border last night. We finally left and got to the talk about an hour and a half late. It's very moving to be here in this room at the University of Victoria because I just learned it was named for a women's studies professor who was a favorite here at the University of Victoria, Michelle Pujol. I almost didn't take this trip because my mom took ill at the end of August. She was a wonderful woman, 79 years old, extremely healthy. She was trekking through the mountains of New Hampshire in August. But she came back, she had a pain in her side, went to the doctor, he said not to worry. She didn't even have a doctor, actually, because she was so healthy. But she went to the doctor, he said, don't worry. But I knew if she was complaining about something, it must be serious. And I called the doctor and asked him to check her out further. And he did a CAT scan and found 4th stage metastasized cancer. She went into the hospital at the beginning of September in New York. And my 3 brothers and I spent the next 5 weeks with her. We basically didn't leave her side. It was catastrophic. It's not just in the United States, the lack of health insurance for people. The entire system is broken. The entire system is sick. We were basically standing at her door at the hospital with armed with a big sign that said, do no harm. But we couldn't do for her what she had done for us our whole lives, which was protect her. In the end, we couldn't protect her. Just to give an example of the problem with healthcare, you know, not seeing, first of all, the patient overall, not to mention every organ connected to every other. She was on clears, you know, only broth, tea, water, apple juice, perhaps Jell-O, and the surgeon had prescribed this. And a swallow expert came in the room one day, and she had with her yogurt and crackers. And I thought she just had come into the wrong room. And she said to my mother, we have to test your swallowing abilities. And my mother's eyes are getting wide. She says, what kind of yogurt is that? She hadn't eaten in weeks. And said, it's blueberry yogurt. I mean, to my mother, this was the richest ice cream, you know. And I said, oh, there must be some mistake. My mom can only have clears. And she said, this isn't about the food. This is about testing the swallowing mechanism. And I said, I don't get it. I don't have a medical degree, but I did graduate from elementary school. And if she swallows that, it will go into her system. And that's what she's not allowed to do. And they called in the doctor and they told me to step aside, that they are in charge of the care, not me. And so she swallowed this yogurt, got deathly ill. And the surgeon came in. And because he knew we were controlling her care, he turned to me and said, what about clears, don't you understand? Just one little example. Or another time, I mean, she was in every single intensive care unit at the hospital at Mount Sinai in New York, considered one of the elite best hospitals in the country. And she came out of recovery, she came into the recovery room from surgery, and I swear she was almost never unconscious. Everyone else was unconscious, obviously. They were anesthetized, they'd just come out of surgery, and she's laying there, and we're around her, and the doctor's there, and she says, 3,000, 3,000. And I said, what? And she said, 3,000, 3,000 what, Mom? 3,000, 3,000. The doctor says, 3,000 what? She said, the Chinese figured out pain management 3,000 years ago. Why haven't you figured it out yet? That was my mom. So I was sitting there one day in the hospital. I used to leave in the morning to go to Democracy Now. By the way, how many of you listen to Democracy Now here on CFUB? Absolutely wonderful. How many of you watch or listen online? Fantastic. We had a huge landmark a few months ago. We are now broadcasting on over 800 public radio and television stations. We're broadcasting in South Africa and in Sweden. Japan once a week translated. You can go to democracynow.jp and see it in Japanese. We're broadcasting in Austria every day. I just did a keynote address there on Skype to welcome the Austrian community to Democracy Now! We broadcast the headlines in Spanish for any radio station to take is over 250 or because the Spanish language media, like English language media, is so hyper-commercialized and consolidated. They suffer from the same problems we suffer from, just getting independent information. And the other landmark we have hit is we've just moved from our beloved Firehouse studio, a landmark building more than 100 years old, and we've built our own, the most eco-friendly internet radio TV studio in the United States. And we've just moved into our permanent home. The first broadcast will be when I come back from here on Monday, and we're just tremendously excited about this, really creating a classroom for the future of and to train independent journalists for the next generation. And that is our commitment, also translating the broadcast in a number of different languages, the whole TV broadcast and radio broadcast. It's the answer to corporate globalization. That's grassroots globalization, communicating with people all over the world. And I'm just in the hospital. It was so sad. We were not that many blocks from our new open space, and my mother had so wanted to see it as the staff moved in, and my coworkers made a wonderful video for her, touring her around the facility and sent it up to the hospital. But I was sitting there one day reading, you know, the advertorials in the New York Times. They were pioneered by like ExxonMobil. They're on the op-ed page. They look like an editorial, so you might be fooled. It's just corporate propaganda, and they pay for the space. And this one was an ad for a hospital, but it was written, the piece was written by Dr. Diane Meyer. And it said that the two things patients need most are time with their doctor. It's as if the doctor is moonwalking out before they even enter the room. They're gone that fast. And pain management. Pain makes you sicker. And it takes listening. It takes time. It takes focusing on the person as a person. Whether they're going to get better, or whether they're at the end of their lives. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is the hospital we want to be in. And I saw Dr. Diane Meyer at Mount Sinai Hospital. That's the hospital we were in. She is a pioneer in the palliative care movement, which is a new movement in the United States and very important. And what a difference she made when we realized she was there and finally met her in those last weeks. Taught us how to care, how to have the final conversations. She said at the end of life, you want to... Do you have that, Dan? Okay. She said at the end of life, you want to be able to say five things. Thank you. Forgive me. I forgive you. I love you. And goodbye. And how to deal with all of the friends that my mom had that were like family, who were clamoring to come, who wanted to see her, and yet she was so sick. And Dr. Meyer said, have them write letters. Not like, get well soon. But letters about their experiences together, their lives together, or something that was meaningful. And we read these emails at her bedside, and it was so beautiful. Really reliving her life with her. And she would say, read that paragraph again. Oh, is that what that meant to him or to her? Assume this was already read last night at the border, so I'll just be reading it again to you. But, and then what to do about the grandchildren. I've been talking about my mother now through this tour. Last night I couldn't quite say that at the border. It just seemed in this, what had become a profane place to even mention my mother's name. But how the children, do we take them to her? What will be their memory of her if they see her at the end of her life? But my mother was radiant, as she always was, transcendent. And we brought my brother's children. We brought Jasper and Eli, Sarah, 10, 11, 12, Ariel, who's 17, Anna, who's 23, and gonna head off to medical school soon. And it was so beautiful to see this, to see my mom with Eli, who's 11, who composed a symphony for her on his computer and played it for her in the hospital room. Or Anna, who has this magnificent voice, and she sang her full throttle in the hospital at last. Jasper, who's 10, just saying, Ema, I love you. And Ariel, who's gonna be going off to college and wrote her college essay on my mom, read my mom a letter. She'd stayed up all night writing it. This is a part of it. She said, as my dad said, this Yom Kippur, you have been inscribed in the book of life, the book of eternal life, that is. You'll never, ever be forgotten by this world that you've loved with all the grit you could muster, because this world loves you back. You've done your work, my dear Ema. You've loved until the ground quaked beneath you. Your light has manifested itself in everyone you meet, especially me. I too will die happy if I can be half the woman you are. So go. Go, my Ema, and know that we are here with you, cheering for you in every step of your journey, just as you've always done with us. When I started calling you Ema at the age of 4 or 5, I didn't know that it was Hebrew for mother, yet I cannot think of a more perfect term to describe you. You're forever my mother, just as you are the mother of a family whose love and connections you gave birth to. And moreover, the mother of love and humanity, because everywhere you've been in your life, you've birthed kindness. kindness. Thank you for what you've given me. You've given me everything. I honor you and I honor this passage, which no matter how hard it is for us, I know you must take. I believe truly that nothing is ever lost. Therefore, I say, go, Ima, with tears in my eyes, but also with a wise-ass smirk, which I believe I acquired from you, knowing that you will never, ever part with me for as long as I live. Safe travels, my beautiful, sensational grandmother. Safe travels. I love you, Ariel. Ariel, 17. And my mother, speaking back to them, that she would always be with them. You know, Jasper, who's a Red Sox fan in Fenway Park, she would be there. Anna, when she's doing her grand rounds, she would be there. Ariel, who's a great soccer star, win or lose, my mom would be right with her on the field. And so when my mom died on October 5th, then we had the funeral. And every one of her grandchildren stood up and told their stories. And then her friends and, of course, us, her kids. I read the poem that I read for my dad, who died 10 years ago. They were a remarkable partnership. They were so deeply in love their whole lives, had so much respect, shared so much interest in literature and history, in film and documentary, and their travels. Do not stand at my grave and weep. I am not there. I do not sleep. I'm a thousand winds that blow. I am the diamond glints on snow. I'm the sunlight on ripened grain. I am the gentle autumn rain. When you awaken in the morning's hush, I'm the swift, uplifting rush of quiet birds in circling flight. I'm the soft star that shines at night. Do not stand at my grave and cry. I am not there. I did not die. And when I heard about the woman who this room is named after, Michelle Pujol, I was deeply struck to hear that she died of cancer. She was a women's studies professor. And my mom taught women's studies for years in the 1970s. She taught women's history and literature. And she taught it to cops and firefighters and civil servants who, if they got a few extra credits, they would get a higher salary. So they thought, oh, chick lit, what could be easier, right? Women's literature. And she would introduce them to Toni Morrison and to Virginia Woolf, and soon they would be bringing...
For the prices needed for the mail, the newspaper guy. Jerry, sorry.
Oh, that's okay. The border guard forgot to check one last thing, so Dennis is bringing it to him. When... As she was teaching them and introducing them to these new worlds of literature and ways of thinking, they'd be bringing their wives and then their daughters to the class. You know, it was really the blossoming of women's liberation. And they were coming to understand through literature why their wife was maybe pulling away or pulling closer, or why they couldn't understand their daughter at all. And they wanted to share this. By the end of the semesters, the classes would swell, would be packed. And so then my mother decided to go back to school and get a degree in clinical social work to work with families in a different way. She never stopped asking questions. In fact, it was her and my dad's curiosity, I think, that they just imbued us with. This intense interest in the world. My mom and dad met at a Hebrew-speaking camp. They weren't allowed to speak English. They went to camp with Noam and Carol Chomsky. And Noam and Carol knew each other since they were 2 years old in Philadelphia. my father and Noam were bunkmates. And my father would always say, "How's Noam Chomsky?" And I say, "Dad, he's a linguist. It's Chomsky." And to show how complex my mother was, one year she was voted funniest camper, and the next year she was voted most serious camper. But even through their lives as they traveled, when my dad died, she never stopped traveling. She lived a full life after he left, of course enriched by every part of their relationship and his being, as we all were. But what a model she was to us. She went to Iran, she went to Turkey, she went to Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, she went to Israel, and she went to Palestine. Now, they've been to Israel a number of times. But Palestine, occupied territory, she went with a tour group, a human rights delegation. They were led by a Palestinian tour guide. And I don't remember if it was Bethlehem or Jericho, and I can't even ask her now. But they got to this checkpoint, and the soldiers had apparently agreed to let them go through. But when the Palestinian guide went up to them, they said no. And then my mother went up to them. Now, she spoke a kind of classical Hebrew that she learned so many decades ago. And I think it was like Shakespearean English. And she goes up to these soldiers that could have been her grandchildren. And she said something like, "You will part the ways." And these soldiers separated, and they let the entire tour group go through. And that Palestinian tour guide, wide-eyed, put his arms around my mother, and he said, "I'm sticking with you." And that has been my philosophy my whole life. I'm sticking with her. My parents created a cocoon for my brothers and me, of love, of intense interest in the world. But it was a cocoon that we had to move out of, that they wanted us to move out of. Sure, in the family, that's what we knew we could always retreat to. But when my mom was a little girl, her father was an Orthodox rabbi, ran the local yeshiva school in Brooklyn, New York. And they would go away in the summer to the Catskills, to this bungalow colony. She talked about one year when she was playing outside, a whale went up in the colony, and it was her mother, my grandmother, who died at the age recently of 108, which is why we never had any thoughts about losing my mom so early. But she talked about this whale, and she ran back to the bungalow. My grandmother had received a letter from a family member that a number of our family members had died in the Holocaust. And what we got from that, what my parents conveyed to us, because we lived with that as the backdrop as we grew up, was never again for anyone, anywhere, never again. That sense that we have a certain time on this earth, and we have an obligation to ensure as best that we can that if anyone is oppressed, we are all oppressed. If anyone is in pain, we have to try to alleviate that pain. That cocoon we had at home, if we could somehow expand it to circle the globe, but at least try as best we can to help people. That's the gift that my mother gave us. And in the last days before she died, I have Dennis to thank for this, who helped me write every column and who made sure this book got out. I was able to give her the published book. She had the first copy on her bedstand, and I opened it to the dedication page, "To my mother, Dari Goodman, the most remarkable woman I have ever known." I thought I'd start, as I told the guard last night, with the last column. Imagine America, 2009, 45,000 people have died in one year, an average of well over 100 a day. Who's taking them out? Who's killing them? To investigate, President Obama might be tempted to call on Jack Bauer, the fictional rogue intelligence agent from the hit TV series 24. Do any of you Canadians watch 24? Do you know what it is? 24, the who 24 is the series where, well, that features this tortured torturer who invariably employs torture and a host of other illegal tactics to help the president fight terrorism, but terrorism isn't the culprit here. It's lack of adequate health care. 45,000 people die a year as a result of lack of health care. So maybe the president's solution isn't Jack Bauer, but rather the actor who plays him. The star of 24 is Kiefer Sutherland, whose family has very deep connections to healthcare reform here in Canada. Sutherland is the grandson of the late Tommy Douglas. You know, his mother is Helen Douglas, the actress, his father, Donald Sutherland. Shirley Douglas, thank you. His family couldn't afford treatment, but a doctor treated him for free, provided that his medical students could observe. Tommy Douglas saw the impact of widespread poverty caused by the Great Depression. He went ultimately into politics, became the premier of Saskatchewan, and yes, his biggest battle, for which he's most well known, is the creation of universal health insurance called Medicare. So it passed in Saskatchewan in 1962. I hope you correct me if I get any of this wrong, because I've been saying this to American audiences now for months. But not before there was a doctor's strike of 23 days that was supported by the U.S.-based American Medical Association, I believe because they were afraid the contagion would spread south. And at the same time that Medicare, which was so successful in Saskatchewan, was then adopted by all of Canada, in the U.S., a similar battle was raging, resulting in the passage of Medicare and Medicaid, giving guaranteed single-payer health care to senior citizens and the poor. Now, Rush Limbaugh says 24 is one of his favorite shows. He's visited the set of 24. He should learn from the real-life actor who plays his hero, Jack Bauer, though I dare say he would not find truth as satisfying as fiction. In 2004, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation poll named Tommy Douglas the greatest Canadian. At a protest in 2000 in Alberta, defending Canada's public single-payer system, Kiefer Sutherland said, "Private health care doesn't work. America's trying to change their system. It's too expensive to get comprehensive medical care in the U.S. Why on earth are we going to follow their system here? I consider it a humanitarian issue. There's an issue about what is right and wrong, what is decent and what is not. Maybe Jack Bauer can save the day." You know, he was asked a few years ago by a reporter how he expects to fill the shoes of his father, Donald Sutherland. And he said, "It's not my father I'm concerned about. It's my grandfather." Well, if he gave a speech like this in the United States, you know, 24 appeals to a very right-wing audience in the United States. Actually, soldiers so often cite it who've been to Iraq and Afghanistan, and this is a grave concern, you know, those who engaged in torture at Abu Ghraib, at Guantanamo, at Bagram. And so it is of such grave concern that generals at West Point have gone to the heads of Fox and asked them to tone down the torture. But maybe if Kiefer Sutherland did give a speech like this in the United States about health care, he could fill his grandfather's shoes. Standing up, how important it is. I mean, in the United States, on Veterans Day, on Democracy Now!, we brought on Dr. Steffi Woolhandler. She's at Harvard Medical School. And they released a study on Veterans Day that estimates four times as many U.S. Army veterans died last year because they lacked health insurance than the total number of U.S. soldiers who were killed in Iraq and Afghanistan in the same period. This research team at Harvard Medical School says over 2,200 veterans under the age of 65 died in 2008 because they were uninsured. That's amazing. And sticking with this issue of soldiers and vets, one of the things that we're proudest of at Democracy Now! Is what we call trickle-up journalism. You do a story enough times, and it'll just trickle up. And when you see exclusive on one of the networks or in one of the newspapers, for us that usually means, according to Democracy Now!, But that's okay, because our motto is steal this story, please. Now, I watched soap operas growing up. And for millions of women in the United States, I know what draws people, men and women, girls and boys, to soap operas. Because you get involved in people's lives. You wonder, what happens the next day? Oh my God, did she sleep with him? And what dress did she wear to this? And who's doing that? You get so captivated because it's human beings, even though they're nothing like you and me, but they're still, you know, you're entering their lives. I actually take the same approach to Democracy Now, which is, though, taking important issues and finding the people at the core of those issues and then following them every day. What happened to Janet? What happened to Greg? He went off to Iraq. He was recruited out of high school. Then what happened? And these are the stories that can be repeated over the fence to your neighbor that can make a difference, that can change the world. And here's an example. Right a few weeks ago, I met this couple named Janet and Greg Kiesling. They're from Indianapolis, and they told me about their son, U.S. Army Reserve Specialist Chancellor Kiesling. He died in Iraq on June 19th. The Pentagon called it a non-combat related incident. Chance Kiesling killed himself. He was just one in what's turning out to be a record year for suicides in the U.S. military. You know what happened at Fort Hood, the largest army base in the United States in Texas a few weeks ago, and the mass killing, 13 people killed, more than 30 wounded. A number that isn't talked about as much at Fort Hood is how many soldiers commit suicide just there. It's an average of roughly one a month, maybe 67 over the last 6 years. It's incredible. Well, in August, President Obama addressed the Veterans of Foreign Wars Convention, saying there's nothing more sobering than signing a letter of condolence to the family of a serviceman or woman who's given their life for our country. Well, to their surprise, Janet and Greg Kiesling, Chance's parents, won't be getting such a letter, because Obama does not write condolence letters to loved ones of those who commit suicide in the theater of combat. He's just following in the footsteps of President Bush. Chance's mother, Janet, said, "Chancellor was recruited right out of high school, and this was something he was passionate about, joining the military. I wanted him to go to college," she said, "but he said he wanted to be a soldier." Greg added, "We had doubts about him joining when the war broke out in 2003, when many of us were trying to retreat. Chancey decided this is my duty, but once he did his first tour, his marriage broke up during that deployment." The issue of recruitment in the military in the United States. Most parents don't realize that all the information about kids in high school are handed over to the Pentagon unless a parent proactively tells the school, "Do not send the information." And you know, they have a lot of information on kids. Yes, test scores, you know, what their grades are in school, but also they have a lot of database information about the things they like to do. And the recruiters get the kids' cell phones. Because the greatest obstacle to a recruiter is mom. They have to circumvent mom, who gets involved and says, like, "I don't want you to go into the military." You know, now it's not just reading, writing, and arithmetic in school. It's reading, writing, arithmetic, and recruiting. It's a very serious issue, and they're aggressively doing this. During the Bush years, for the first time, they did not meet their recruiting goals, and so it got more and more serious. Because, you know, you get these young recruiters learning about the lives of, let's say, these high school girls, and they're calling them up, and they're saying, "We're going to meet you," all sorts of issues of sexual harassment and other things. But they didn't meet their recruiting goals. Now, for the first time, they are. Because of the economic downturn, the economic meltdown. Kids can't find jobs, and they're promised a job out of the military. They get money now. They are promised money for college. Just to give a sense of the intense recruiting that is going on and why so many young people may well be going into the military now and then get disillusioned. I mean, the number of, another big story is the number of soldiers who are not going to Iraq and Afghanistan. By Pentagon's figures, we're talking thousands and thousands who are refusing to go, but they don't talk about it. The military doesn't like to talk about the level of resistance in the military. But back to Chance. He goes on duty. He goes to Iraq. His marriage falls apart. You know, these young soldiers, they're going 2, 3, 4 times for well over a year each time. And their lives are falling apart. So Chance comes home. It's not just his marriage. He himself is falling apart. The military offers him a multi-$1,000 recruitment bonus to return immediately to Iraq. He says he can't. He goes to a VA facility, a Veterans Affairs facility, to get psychological treatment. He goes into the U.S. Army Reserves, hoping to avoid another deployment. His dad said, we sat down as a family and said, President Obama's going to be elected. Obama will end this war. You won't have to go. But then his son's orders to deploy came again. And he ends up in Iraq again this year. And he sends an email to his parents that, well, the first time, and this is why it was so serious, the first time he was in Iraq, when his wife left him, though he performed admirably by all accounts as a soldier, at one point he was put on a suicide watch and had his ammunition taken away from him for a week. So when he came home, this was really, really serious. But then he's redeployed. He goes back, sends a letter to his parents mentioning suicide. His mother talks to him, and she says he's his usual tough exterior, says he's going to have a very hard day. He usually says, I love you and goodbye. She said it was just a 4-minute conversation. And he hung up. The next day, his dad, Greg, said Chance locked himself in the latrine and took his own life with his M4. He said, our grief is deep. The letter won't stop our pain. We'll still be hollow inside for the rest of our lives. But the acknowledgement from the president that our son gave his life in service to the causes of the United States is important to us. The Pentagon admits it has a mounting suicide crisis in its ranks. Numbers of acknowledged suicides have steadily climbed. It was about 100 in 2005, now 200 in 2008. Greg Kiesling said when he and Janet went to Dover Air Base to meet Chance's coffin, a master sergeant encouraged them to speak out, saying, I'm greeting a suicide body almost every day. There's something going on. The Kieslings credit Major General Mark Graham with helping them through their grief and working to reduce the stigma of suicide within the military. One of Graham's sons committed suicide in 2003 while studying as an Army ROTC cadet in college. His other son, also in the Army, deployed to Iraq a few months later and was killed by a bomb. The United States is engaged in 2 intractable, massive military occupations with no end in sight. Obama should certainly write letters of condolence to the Kieslings and to others whose loved ones have found that the only sure way to end the living hell of war or to escape the horror of its aftermath is to kill themselves. But an immediate withdrawal from the wars Obama inherited is the only way to stem the bleeding. Amazing that President Obama will be receiving the Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo on December 10th, just after he announces an escalation of the war in Afghanistan, which he will do next week, estimates of 35,000 more troops to be sent to Afghanistan.
And won't sign the landmine agreement.
And, yes, thank you. Clearly a listener of Democracy Now! I mean, almost alone in the world on this issue of not signing the landmine ban. He just announced a few days ago that he'll be going to Copenhagen. In this book tour I've been doing of the last few weeks, I've raised this every day 4 times a day, how remarkable it was, and this is why I had Copenhagen on my mind. The only time I talk about the Olympics is that President Obama went to Copenhagen to push for the Olympics to go to Chicago. So he certainly knows where it is. But it was only yesterday that he announced that he would be going to Copenhagen for the climate change conference, which is important, which some have called, well, I mean, it's only slightly more important than the Olympics. You know, his announcement was absolutely critical because what happened the minute he announced it, your own Prime Minister Stephen Harper announced, oh, maybe he would also go. But that is the effect when the most powerful person on earth says he will go to a conference like this. It elevates the conference, and soon world leaders from everywhere will go, and it also puts greater pressure to come up with a resolution, although President Obama said there will not be a binding resolution that comes out of it, which is why I think he's not going the day after the Peace Prize, but the day before, because then the headlines will just be dominated by the Nobel Peace Prize the next day. People are taking a stand, though, and that is really important. I just wanted to read a few columns, and if you're regular listeners to Democracy Now!, you've met some of these people. But on Democracy Now!, we don't bring you the typical pundits, right? Think about what you get on the networks, this small circle of pundits who know so little about so much, explaining the world to us and getting it so wrong. We've got to break the sound barrier. Remember, it's not just that we have to build independent media, which we do, and why it's so wonderful to be celebrating and you supporting CFUV and all community radio. This is absolutely critical. But we have to challenge the corporate media. In the United States, you know, you have the networks. NBC is owned by General Electric, one of the major weapons manufacturers. Is it any accident what we watch on TV or military hardware shows, cheerleaders for war? And it matters because, yeah, they're private corporations, but they don't own the airwaves. The airwaves are a national treasure. They are the public's airwaves. They're the place where we have to hash out the most critical issues of the day. This land is your land, and the way you protect it is by challenging these corporations to open up, to allow those thinkers, those activists, those people who think outside the box, think of the TV screen as that box that boxes us in. On Democracy Now!, we break all of the standard wisdom about how what appeals to people on television or in radio. You're supposed to have 8-second sound bites, especially kids. They can't tolerate anything more, the whole MTV thing. It's the opposite. Young people, Democracy Now! Turns public radio and television on its head, bringing in a younger, more diverse audience. Because to hear someone start in one place and take a journey with you somewhere else, how they arrive, it's called critical thinking. How you start one place and end up in a very different place. You got to hear how someone does that, how they arrive at a completely different conclusion that isn't reinforcing the status quo. We can't afford the status quo anymore. Global warming, the global economic meltdown. It's dissent that will save us. And we need a media that is safe for dissent. We need to be able to traverse borders without being afraid that that dissent will be squelched, that you'll be monitored, that you'll be surveilled, that you'll be watched. Dissent is essential to the functioning of a democratic society. And so we bring you people like, Tim DeChristopher. How many of you remember him as I stand here at the University of Victoria, to bring you the story of another student, Tim DeChristopher, is an economics student at the University of Utah, Salt Lake City. The piece is called Bush and the Monkey Wrench Guy, or One Man's Bid to Aid the Environment. It was last December, a year ago, and Tim was taking his economics exam. One of the questions on the exam was, if the oil and gas companies are the only ones who bid on public lands, are the true costs of oil and gas exploitation reflected in the prices paid? Tim was inspired. He finished his exam, he threw on his red parka, and went off to the controversial Bureau of Land Management land auction, that's BLM land auction, that the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance called the Bush administration's last great gift to the oil and gas industry. Instead of joining the protest outside, he thought, what is a land auction? Like, how does it work? And he went inside, and he saw that they weren't bonding the bidders, so he picked up paddle 70 and he started bidding on the public land, and he didn't stop. He ended up buying 22,000 acres of public land. That is, he successfully bid on the public properties located near the Arches and Canyonlands National Parks and Dinosaur National Monument and other pristine areas. The price tag, more than $1.8 million dollars that he just didn't happen to have in his wallet at the time. He only came on Democracy Now! Right after that, and he said, once I started buying up every parcel, they understood pretty clearly what was going on. They stopped the auction, some federal agents came in and took me out. I guess there was a lot of chaos. They didn't really know how to proceed at that point. They arrested him. Patrick Shea became his lawyer. Patrick Shea is the former director of the Bureau of Land Management. Never assume who your opponents are. Because in this time of such dire crises, I really think conservative and liberal lines are breaking down. It's certainly the case for the millions of viewers and listeners and readers of Democracy Now! I mean, it absolutely crosses the political spectrum. Conservative Republicans, like progressives, like independents, like Democrats, care about corporate control, care about issues of privacy, yes, even war and torture. There's a lot more common ground than is evidenced by this artificial 8-second soundbite debate, fisticuffs on television. I really do think that those who are opposed to war and those who are opposed to torture are not a fringe minority, not even a silent majority, but the silenced majority, silenced by the corporate media, which is why we have to take it back. I mean, FAIR did the study, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR.org, a media watch group in New York, of the four major nightly newscasts in the United States 5 weeks before the invasion of Iraq. They looked at NBC Nightly News, ABC World News Tonight, CBS Evening News, and the PBS News Hour with Jim Lehrer. PBS is like CBC. In the 2 weeks around then Secretary of State Colin Powell giving his push for war at the United Nations, there were 393 interviews done around war. Guess how many were with anti-war leaders? This was when half the population was opposed to the war. Zero is an underestimate. Three is a Democracy Now! Listener. Yes. Three. Three of almost 400. You weren't that off with zero. Three of almost 400. That is no longer a mainstream media. That's an extreme media beating the drums for war. Someone asked me recently what I think of the mainstream media. I think it would be a good idea. So, Patrick Shea, a former director of the Bureau of Land Management, represents Tim DeChristopher. He told the Deseret News, what Tim did was in the best tradition of civil disobedience. He did this without causing any physical or material harm. His purpose was to draw attention to the illegitimacy and immorality of the process. There's a long tradition of disrupting land development in Utah. In his memoir, Desert Solitaire, Edward Abbey, the writer and the activist, wrote, "Wilderness, the word itself, is music. We scarcely know what we mean by the term, though the sound of it draws all whose nerves and emotions have not yet been irreparably stunned, deadened, numbed by the caterwauling of commerce, the sweating scramble for profit and domination." Edward Abbey's novel, The Monkey Wrench Gang, inspired a generation of environmental activists to take direct action disrupting so-called development. As the Salt Lake Tribune reported on Tim DeChristopher, he didn't pour sugar into a bulldozer's gas tank. He didn't spike a tree or set a billboard on fire. But wielding only a bidder's paddle, a University of Utah student just as surely monkey-wrenched a federal oil and gas lease sale Friday, ensuring that thousands of acres near two southern Utah national parks won't be open to drilling anytime soon. So let me give you the latest on Tim DeChristopher. He was arrested under the Bush administration, right? And then Ken Salazar, the former senator from Colorado, becomes the Interior Secretary. And the whole land auction, Tim DeChristopher succeeded in nullifying the whole auction because he not only bought up all this land, like 22,000 acres, but for the land he didn't win, he drove up the prices for the oil and gas companies because he kept picking up his paddle. So it nullified the whole thing. And then there were a number of days that the auction could be repeated, and that went into the Obama administration, and Ken Salazar said it wouldn't be re-auctioned. That's very significant. But also under the Obama administration, Tim DeChristopher was charged with a number of felonies, and he's going to trial now. He faces many years in prison as economic student at the University of Utah. And he lost a big round last week, the beginning of the trial, because he wanted to raise a global warming defense. And among those he wanted to testify was James Hansen. He's one of the leading climatologists in the world. He is the head of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies. And he himself just got arrested in Virginia protesting mountaintop removal and, you know, coal mining. And the judge said no. So now it's just going to be this case of sort of this fraud that was perpetrated. This kid walks into this auction and starts buying up land. But as Patrick Shea said, his attorney, it won't be the first time that someone claimed they had money that they didn't. So, interesting people taking interesting actions. How many of you have heard of the Yes Men? Word travels, God forbid if they do, over the Canadian border. A couple weeks ago, the Yes Men held this news conference at the National Press Club. Well, they staged another of their hoaxes. They posed as officials from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, leading what appeared to be a legitimate news conference, stating the chamber's complete reversal on its historically adamant opposition to climate change legislation. Okay, wait, I want to give you a little history here before we get into what they are doing now. You know, they're the artist activist group. I was just with them at the New York Public Library a few weeks ago because they were being honored by an artist group called Creative Time. They stage elaborate hoaxes on global trade organizations, multinational corporations, and politicians. They satirically skewer corporate free trade, pro-business positions by acting as genuine, sincere spokesjerks for these institutions. So, in a week, we're going to see the 25th anniversary of the Bhopal disaster. You know what happened, Union Carbide, the gas leak. It killed thousands of Bhopal residents 25 years ago, December 2nd, 3rd, 4th, in India. Union Carbide was then bought up by Dow Chemical. Well, 5 years ago, in December of 2004, well, it was probably a little earlier in November, a little earlier than this, the Yes Men set up a website called, I think it was something like DowEthics.com, and the BBC emailed Dow Ethics and asked a Dow representative to come on to talk about the Bhopal disaster 20 years later. They emailed DowEthics.com. Now, already, Dow Ethics should have been a red flag. So, you know, the Yes Men did what only the Yes Men can do, and that is said yes. They would come on BBC to talk about the Bhopal disaster. Now, Andy Biggelbaum, one of the Yes Men who lives in Paris, couldn't afford a ticket to go to the interview in London, so they set up a studio for him in Paris, and the London's BBC anchor started the interview. Oh, Andy had adopted the name Jude Finisterra. That's Finisterra, end of the earth. So the BBC begins the interview. Mr. Finisterra, Dow spokesperson, what do you have to say on this 20th anniversary of the Bhopal disaster? And he said, I am sorry. I apologize to the people of Bhopal for what we did to them 20 years ago. And as we speak, we are liquidating Union Carbide. And we will give the $12 billion to the suffering people of Bhopal. Suddenly, on BBC television is flashing, breaking news. And the union and the BBC anchor is saying, Mr. Finisterra, if you could just repeat what you have just said. And he said, and the BBC anchor is saying, you're liquidating Union Carbide and giving the money to the people of the suffering people of Bhopal. And then this goes on for 5 minutes, is the end of the interview, and Dow Chemical is just enraged. They call up the BBC, they say, you have been hoaxed. And then a red-faced BBC gets on and says, this is not true. We have been duped, and this was a fraud. And the Yes Men do not skip a beat. They immediately issue a press release on the Dow Ethics stationery that says, we do not apologize to the people of Bhopal, and we will not compensate them for their suffering. That's just an example of what they do. So in 2007, for a little more history, Yes men's Biklebaum and Mike Bonanno addressed Canada's largest oil conference, posing as executives of ExxonMobil and the National Petroleum Council. They announced a plan to convert the corpses of the expected millions of victims of climate change into a fuel they called Vivoleum. They were ejected, after which Bonanno told the press, while ExxonMobil continues to post record profits there, they use their money to persuade governments to do nothing about climate change. This is a crime against humanity, he said. So now let's go back to a few weeks ago at the National Press Club. I think they paid $500 to rent the room as the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And Andy Biklebaum reads from a statement. He says, we at the Chamber have tried to keep climate science from interfering with business, but without a stable climate, there will be no business. Fox Business News goes live to the National Press Club. Breaking news. CNBC picks this up. Reuters, other world news outlets carry the story of the Chamber's surprise support for climate change legislation. During the news conference, an actual U.S. Chamber of Commerce employee enters the room irate, loudly declaring the event is a fraud, but exposing himself to probing questions about the Chamber's position on climate change. Now, a number of major corporations have pulled out of the Chamber because of their opposition to genuine climate change legislation, including Apple, Exelon, PG&E, and Levi Strauss. The U.S. Chamber's resistance to science-based climate policy is nothing new. The next day, we had Andy Biklebaum on Democracy Now. We showed the news conference. You can go to democracynow.org and just put in Yes Men, and that was the last time we had them on, so you'll see the whole thing. But we also had on one of your own. We had on a Canadian who was a PR exec for decades here, and then he wrote a kind of confessional. He wrote a book called Climate Cover-Up, The Crusade to Deny Global Warming. His name is Jim Hogan. And he was on the show as well, sitting next to me in New York, and he was listening to the Yes Men describe the story, and he watched the news conference, and he said, the PR stunt wasn't pulled off by the Yes Men. The PR stunt is basically being pulled off by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and it's been going on for decades. His book describes what he calls a two-decade-long campaign by the energy industry in Canada and the United States, basically designed to confuse the public about climate change and to give people the sense there's a debate about the science of climate change. Now, lest you get despondent or give up hope, October 24th was amazing. There were more than 5,000 events, protests, rallies, all over the world, one of the largest mass protests in world history. Just this last October 24th, it was inspired by the group 350.org, named after what scientists have identified as a sustainable target for carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere, 350 parts per million. We're at 387 ppm right now, parts per million. And people did things all over, like the president of the Republic of the Maldives, President Mohamed Nasheed. He held an underwater cabinet meeting, donning scuba gear and literally meeting in 20 feet of water in the world's lowest lying country. I'm not kidding. He held a cabinet meeting underwater, the entire cabinet of the Maldives, except for two members who didn't know how to scuba dive. They signed an SOS from the frontline declaration, reading in part, if we can't save the Maldives today, you can't save the rest of the world tomorrow. He'll carry this declaration to Copenhagen. Democracy Now! Will be there. We're leaving next Friday to cover the two-week summit, from the streets to the suites to the summit, the executives, the world leaders, the people in the streets who feel that not having a resolution that is binding is a problem. We'll bring you all of it. President Obama's announced that there won't be any kind of binding resolution. The U.S. Senate didn't pass any binding legislation around climate change. Does it have anything to do with the fact that the U.S. coal, gas, oil interests are spending $300,000 a day lobbying the government? Now, that is very significant in the same way that with health insurance, the insurance industry, big pharma, the drug companies are pouring $1 million a day into the U.S. Congress to stop any kind of serious health care reform. We cannot forget that the 2010 midterm elections are coming up in the United States, and then it's the presidential election again. Money in politics is what the elections, unfortunately, in the United States have so much come to be what politics is about. We have to take the money out of politics. Campaign finance reform is critical to all of these issues that so many hold dear, that will determine the fate of the earth. President Obama, there is no question that that election day, 2008, was a global event. And it was historic. I mean, in a country like ours with a legacy of slavery, the first African-American president elected, among other things, was remarkable. When the election took place, but before President Obama was inaugurated, he and Michelle Obama went to the White House. They were invited by the Bushes, and I was invited on CNN to comment on this moment. It was in the afternoon, and I was sitting in the CNN studio watching the video, and there was some chatter going on about other things on the show, and I'm seeing the Obamas walk into the White House. And they asked me about something else on CNN. I said, no, wait, let's just take pause. Barack Hussein Obama and Michelle LaVon Robinson Obama. Michelle LaVon Robinson Obama, her grandfather came from South Carolina, direct descendant of a slave, which means Michelle Obama, her children, their children, Malia and Sasha Obama, are the descendants of slaves, are now moving into the White House, the most famous house on earth. It was built by slaves. Let's just take pause. Can President Obama redeem the White House? Well, I think it is certainly up to more than him. I mean, here we have the community organizer-in-chief become the commander-in-chief, right? The good thing is now parents all over are saying, maybe to their children, maybe you can be a community organizer too. But he has become the commander-in-chief. And now who is going to do the community organizing? The mantle has shifted to everyone else. Those who are used to walking the West Wing of the White House, whispering in the ear of the most powerful person on earth in the Oval Office, are still doing that. And if he can't point out the window and say, if I do that, they will storm the Bastille, if there's no one out there, he's in big trouble. And that's when you support what he does. But what about when you don't? And I think this does go beyond the U.S. citizenry. It was a global election. And at this point in the world, we are connected through globalization. And what one country does affects everyone else. And so what you do is also very important for the United States. Those demands have now become global, as we see from, well, global warming. There are no borders, there are no boundaries. If only the Border Patrol in Canada could stop global warming from spreading north, right, or going south. When they went into the White House, I thought of a house a couple of hours away in St. Michael's, Maryland. How many of you have heard of Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist in the United States? He was enslaved as a youth and a teenager, born in the Eastern Shore of Maryland. And when he was a teenager, enslaved, he was handed over to a man called a slave breaker. It might not surprise you to know Frederick Douglass was a troublesome slave. And Edward Covey, the slave breaker's property, was called Mount Misery. Frederick Douglass was tortured there. He was beaten. He ultimately fought back. He escaped. He went north. I go to this independent coffee shop in New York, this little coffee shop in a brick building. On the outside is a plaque that says, Frederick Douglass first took refuge here at the printing press of David Ruggles, born a free black man in Connecticut. And I thought that is so interesting. David Ruggles had a printing press. Frederick Douglass started the North Star newspaper. That these men saw media as their means of liberation because information is power. So back to Mount Misery, there in the Eastern Shore of Maryland, where Frederick Douglass was tortured. Mount Misery today is owned by Donald Rumsfeld. It's his vacation home. he bought it in 2003, the Secretary of Defense, to be near his close friend, Vice President Dick Cheney. Now, this is astounding. And I was so shocked as I read this that I thought, you know, I have to go and see with my own eyes. I mean, as a journalist, you really got to check things out. And the internet is so important. It's such an important way to gather information. We have to preserve net neutrality, network neutrality, right, so that the internet remains open and free. We can't let the cable companies and the telecoms write the legislation that would privatize the internet now that it is so important. But the internet can be a global rumor mill, and you have to really be careful. And for you students in the audience, it is so important to double and triple check everything that you read. There is a difference between a blog and investigative journalism, although I think blogs are so important. It is so important to start getting lots of different views out there, different perspective from different parts of the world. But we just have to be very careful, which is also why I'm so excited about Democracy Now! Moving into its new home, this 21st century, most eco-friendly internet radio TV studio in the country, as a classroom with the next generation of independent journalists to really take seriously what journalism is. It can do so much. It can protect so many. So back to St. Michael's, Maryland, and Donald Rumsfeld's Mount Misery. Dennis and I went down to St. Michael's to investigate. This was during the Bush years. We drove into town, and all of a sudden I realized I have no idea where Donald Rumsfeld lives, but I do see an organic coffee shop down the road. You can see a theme in my life. And I thought, well, they'll tell the truth. So I went inside, and they said, what would you like? And I said, I'd like to know where the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, lives. They said, oh, just go out back, drive down the road, you'll hit Mount Pleasant Road, don't go down that road, make a right, then make another right, and that's Mount Misery Road. And you go down Mount Misery Road, he's right at the end there. So we went down the road, we went out back, we hit Mount Pleasant, we didn't go down that road, we took a right and then another right, it seems we couldn't go right enough, and then we found Mount Misery Road, and we went down that road, and then we saw the black-tinted SUV of the Secret Service and knew we had arrived. So I got out with my video camera, and I started zooming in as they were zooming out. And I was thinking, does Donald Rumsfeld know the significance of this property? But sure enough, as I'm zooming in, I hit on the plaque, a stake in the ground that says Mount Misery. So we head over to this old black church. It's Sunday morning, an old dusty road. And it's right before Mass, and the older folks were having Sunday school in the sanctuary. And I went up to one of the older women, and I said, what do you think of this? I mean, this historic place, Frederick Douglass was tortured here. Donald Rumsfeld is known for torture, and he now owns Mount Misery. And she said, I can't comment right now. We're in church. From Mount Misery to Mount Hope. I was speaking a while after that in Geneva, New York, upstate New York. And a young woman came up to me after my talk and she said, would you go with me to Mount Hope Cemetery in Rochester? It's not far from here, just about an hour. I'd like to show you Frederick Douglass's tombstone. It was a big snowstorm. I was leaving very early the next morning. I said, well, if you'll meet me there at 5 a.m, I'd like to see it. She's standing at the gate, we go in, we brush the snow off of Frederick Douglass's tombstone, and it was amazing. And then she got a twinkle in her eye and said, would you go with me across the cemetery? I want to show you one more tombstone. I said, I'm going to miss my plane. She said, oh, it'll be quick. And we're walking, then I'm running, then we're racing, stumbling through the snow. And we come to Susan B. Anthony's tombstone. She's buried next to her sister, the great feminist, the great women's rights activist, suffragette. And you know that Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass were not only close allies, they were close friends. And when I was speaking at Wesleyan College, University in Connecticut, a woman came up and said, did you go to Susan B. Anthony's house? Because there's a sculpture near there, a statue, not of a general on horseback, but of Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass having tea together. Frederick Douglass was a great abolitionist. Susan B. Anthony was also an abolitionist. And just as she was a women's rights activist, so was Frederick Douglass. You know, he attended the Women's Rights Convention at Seneca Falls in 1848. Women's rights, the anti-slavery movement, the civil rights movement, these are the movements that have made our country great. And these are the movements that so often get weeded out by the mainstream media. You know, people come out of movements and they inspire movements, and especially for young people, it's so important to know that you're not just starting from scratch. There would be such an enormous, impossible responsibility to think you have to do it all yourself. You are standing on the shoulders of giants who have come before, who have so much to teach us, and the media should be the place where we learn it all, which is why at Democracy Now! In our new space, we're so excited about gathering this archive, of which we have thousands and thousands of tapes and hours, out of the grassroots movements of the 20th century moving into the 21st century, so it can be a great research space for students, for teachers, for activists to come and learn what people have done in the past. And the trade-off, you log the tapes, you get them, and we get the logging, so everything gets digitized and logged so that other people can use it as well. We have to create our own media, preserve the past so that we can preserve our future. So that's the story of Mount Misery to Mount Hope. I wanted to end with two last stories. One is about surveillance and how serious it is. Why, you know, coming up through the last week, I've been in Olympia, Washington, among other places, and why it was particularly disturbing to go through what we did last night. Olympia, Washington is a place where a group of activists applied to the city for information about any kind of monitoring the military and the police were doing about them. They were anarchists, they were SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, they were Iraq Vets Against the War, they were what's called Port Militarization Resistance, PMR. They were performing civil disobedience at the port to try to prevent the striker brigades from going to Iraq and Afghanistan. We had on Democracy Now! A young man named Brendan Maslauskas Dunn, and I just saw him 2 days ago. He came to the talk. Also there, by the way, Olympia was an amazing gathering where Cindy and Craig Corey, the parents of Rachel Corey, who died trying to defend a Palestinian pharmacist's home that was about to be bulldozed by Israeli military bulldozer made by Caterpillar in the United States. This young woman who went to Evergreen College in Washington, who was crushed to death on March 16, 2003, 3 days before the U.S. invasion of Iraq. I just remember the day well. I was in New York. I got this call from our newsroom about this young woman. A year or two later, I was invited to give the commencement address at Evergreen. It was the largest class, graduating class of Evergreen, and it was a place I met Rachel's parents because she would have graduated that year, and her mom gave the graduation address in her place and in her honor. And 2 days ago when I was in Olympia, Craig and Cindy Corey, Rachel's parents, came out for the talk. And so did Brendan, this young person who applied to the city for all the documents, and he got hundreds of documents despite the U.S. government trying to prevent these documents from being released. And among the documents was an email that was the most disturbing piece of all in the documents he got. It was about a man named John J. Towery II, and as Brendan was reading, he realized this is the person he knew as John Jacob, a close friend, someone who was involved in all of their groups, who is really at the heart of many of their groups. And it turned out he was a spy from Fort Lewis. It was all in the documents that he was spying on these groups and from the military base. This is extremely serious because, well, it's a violation of the Posse Comitatus Act. Posse Comitatus is the act that prevents U.S. military deployment for domestic law enforcement. Extremely serious, because the military is supposed to be barred from being deployed on U.S. soil or from spying on U.S. citizens. Now, Congress members across the country are calling for a full investigation of what is happening. Dissent is what will make us safe, and when it's chilled, we are less safe. I think that's a threat to national security. Now, think about the protests 10 years ago in Seattle, N30, that's November 30th. Monday will be the 10th anniversary. When I was in Astoria, Oregon a few days ago, a young woman came up to me and she said, 10 years ago I was 17, I was a high school student, and I went with a friend to Seattle and we sat down on the street. She said it was my proudest act. She was there with tens of thousands of others, high school students, college students, teachers, nurses, doctors, farmers from all over the world, union leaders, environmentalists, who understood that unbridled capitalism, that these deregulated corporations would lead to all of our demise. And look what has happened 10 years later with the economic meltdown. I mean, these kids, along with all the others, were so prescient. And remember, this meeting of the World Trade Organization that they were protesting, this didn't happen under Bush, this happened under President Clinton. He was trying to fly in the middle of the night. Madeleine Albright was there, and she was weeping in her hotel room, well, because of the tear gas. Now, interestingly, Norm Stamper, the police chief at the time, has apologized for ever, you know, releasing the level of military might against these young people and old. He feels it is the worst mistake he ever made. It's an amazing story, the transformation, actually, of the police chief after he left. But what these people taught us then shows us how important protest is. So a few months ago, at the G20 protest in Pittsburgh, when the group of 20, the industrialized nations, met, it was particularly disturbing to learn about this young man, a New York social worker, who went to join the protests. He was arrested. Then, when he went home to Queens, New York, was subjected to an FBI raid. Why? He used Twitter. Elliot Madison was charged with hindering apprehension of prosecution, criminal use of a communication facility, and possession of instruments of crime. He was posting to a Twitter feed, or tweeting as it's called, publicly available information about police activities around the G20 protests, including information about where police had issued orders to disperse. While alerting people to public information may not seem to be an arrestable offense, be forewarned, many people have been arrested for the same crime. In Iran, that is. Last June 20th, as Iranians protested against the conduct and results of their national election, President Obama issued a statement. He said the universal rights to assembly and free speech must be respected, and the United States stands with all those who seek to exercise those rights. His statement was released in Farsi, in Arabic, and in English, as well as on the White House's own Twitter feed. The presidential tweet read, "We call on the Iranian government to stop all violent and unjust actions against its own people." The State Department weighed in. Impressed with the importance of Twitter to Iranian protests, they asked Twitter to delay system maintenance that might have interrupted the service during the Iranian protests. This is encouraging to Elliot Madison. He said, maybe the State Department will weigh in my own case. Right? He was tweeting where the police were, where they were telling people to disperse so that they would go other places. And he was arrested. Then he comes home. He, his wife, his housemates are roused from sleep during that next weekend when the Joint Terrorism Task Force swept into their house, handcuffed them for hours, searched the house, removed computers and other property from everyone in the house. For 16 hours, Elliot Madison said, the FBI proceeded to take everything from Curious George stuffed animals to kitchen magnets and lots of books. This is extremely serious. Going back to Iran, one of the Twitterers there for the virtual news hub Tehran Bureau recalled the June protests in an essay. An officer spoke to us through a loudspeaker, disperse, this is your last warning, he said. The sight of them made my knees tremble, but the wave pushed on, and so I went along, wrote the Iranian Twitterer. He was beaten, bloodied, arrested, and held for 20 days. Now, Elliot Madison was not physically harmed, but his case could prove central to the future of free speech in the mobile digital age. It's time for the digital censors in the U.S. to disperse. After we interviewed Elliot Madison on Democracy Now, the charges were dropped against him. I mean, it was so ludicrous. I think it was humiliating to the administration. But not without them saying that the case could be reopened at any point. And by the way, on that story of the Kieslings, my final point on that was, we did the story, and then we did it again, and talked about it again. We may not have as large an audience as the corporate networks, although it's getting there. We have millions of viewers, listeners, and readers all over the world. It's truly astounding. But by continuing to do it again and again and follow up, have they received a letter? 2 days ago, as I was walking out on the stage in Bellingham, I got an email from Greg Kiesling. He said, Wall Street Journal is now going live with the story. And today, the New York Times had a front page story on the war condolences the Kieslings have not received. In independent media, we can make a difference. I'm going to end with one story, and then I'll be signing with Dennis, my editor, books, Breaking the Sound Barrier. And we brought some up in case you run out of these. We're very excited to be able to offer them to you. It's easy to read because you can read one column, then you can put it down, you can read another column, but it's an honor to be able to work with an independent press, with Haymarket Books, to work with you all here at the bookstore here. I think bookstores are really a part of the independent media landscape, are sanctuaries of dissent, and must be supported. So I'm just going to end where the CBC began tonight at 6 o'clock on the story of our detention last night at the Douglas border crossing. They started with a video image of my arrest in St. Paul at the Republican convention. Oh, one of the things the border guards asked me last night is, had I ever been arrested? Well, I was, and I told them this at the Republican convention. And it was a very serious violation. More than 40 reporters were arrested at the convention in St. Paul. Now, these conventions, Democratic and Republican conventions, are supposed to be celebrations of democracy. And we went, it was Labor Day, the first day of the convention. 10,000 people marched before the convention opened, led by active duty soldiers, soldiers in uniform, and they risk a lot doing this, and veterans, and then civilians of every stripe, walking from the St. Paul City Hall to the convention center. It was a bright blue day. They marched through the streets opposing the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. They also marched at the Democratic convention. We covered this. Then I went inside the convention to cover the delegates from the hottest state, from Alaska. And my colleagues continued to cover the protests, and I got a call on the cell phone saying that Sharif and Nicole had just been arrested. Nicole Salazar is our multimedia reporter. Sharif is our senior producer, Sharif Odokadus. And they said that they were injured, they were hurt. And I raced off the convention floor to 7th and Jackson, where this arrest was taking place. And it was surrounded by the riot police. I ran up to them. They could see I was a reporter from the convention with all my credentials that allow me to interview presidents and vice presidents and delegates and Congress members. And I said, very quickly, I mean, they had the area fully contained. You can see I'm a credentialed reporter. I need to speak to your commanding officer. Our reporter's inside. They've been arrested. They're credentialed too. We need to have them released. It wasn't seconds before they ripped me through that line, twisted my arms back, slapped the handcuffs on, and pushed me to the ground, and charged me with misdemeanor, interfering with a peace officer. Right, if only there was a peace officer there. And I looked for Sharif. I saw him across the parking lot. He was standing, his arm was bloody, his hands were handcuffed, and he was standing with his credentials. I demanded to be brought to him. We both stood there. We both said loudly, "We are credentialed reporters. You can see this. We want to be released now." Whereupon the Secret Service came and ripped the credentials from around our necks. I was then put into a police wagon where I found Nicole. Her face was bloodied. She was handcuffed. Her credentials were around her neck. And she described quickly what happened. They had continued covering the protest. They had come to this area at 7th and Jackson. The riot police were moving in formation. As they came at her and Sharif, they were filming. They were shouting, "On your face, on your face." She was shouting back, "Press, press." She was holding the camera, she was filming, and they took her down on her face, near boot in her back, pulling on her leg, so they were dragging her face, which is what bloodied it. And the first thing they did was pull the battery out of her camera, if you were wondering what it was they wanted to stop happening. Sharif is a very calm person. He was telling the riot police to calm down. They kicked him twice in the chest, threw him up against the wall, bloodied his arm, handcuffed him. They faced felony riot charges. So I was taken to the police garage where they had erected cages for the protesters. Sharif and Nicole were taken to jail. I dare say it was Twitter, YouTube, email, decentralized forms of communication, and independent media that ultimately freed us. I mean, the video of our arrest went up so fast on YouTube. It went viral immediately. It was the most watched YouTube video the first 2 days of the convention. Within a number of hours, we were freed. And I was taken to the convention because networks wanted to interview me about what had happened. So I'm standing in the NBC skybox, and they're interviewing me. And when they turn the camera off, an NBC reporter is next to me doing some stand-up. And he listened to what I said. And he said, "I don't get it. Why wasn't I arrested?" And I said, "Oh, were you outside covering the protests?" And he said, "No." So I said, "Well, I'm not getting arrested in the skybox either." You know, like Woody Allen says, 90% of life is just showing up. But this is really important. It's our job to cover the orchestrated message from the convention floor, to try to get into those corporate suites that are sponsoring the congressional delegations and the governor's associations. You know, basic tenet of good journalism, follow the money. And it's our job to go out into the streets to capture what the uninvited guests are saying. You know, democracy is a messy thing, and it's our job to capture it all. We shouldn't have to get a record to put things on the record. It's, again, just as with what happened last night, it's not only a violation of freedom of press, it's a violation of your right to know. There cannot be that chilling effect that prevents reporters from going to where the silence is. It's our job. It's our job to show what's happening. Then you make what you will of that. That's how you make your decisions. You know, the first column in Breaking the Sound Barrier is about the lead up to the invasion of Iraq. And it's about a tapestry that hangs outside the UN Security Council. It's a tapestry reproduction of Pablo Picasso's Guernica, this famous painting that Picasso did of the Spanish town during the Franco years that got bombed, and it shows the agony of war, the pain in the faces of the animals and the humans. And it's become an anti-war symbol all over the world. It hangs, this tapestry, at the UN Security Council. Now, when Colin Powell and other Western leaders were making their pro-war announcements at the microphone right outside the Security Council, that was the backdrop of all of these announcements, this tapestry that hung there. And the irony wasn't lost on the UN and US officials, so they shrouded the tapestry. They covered it with a curtain. It's our job to pull that curtain back, to show the reality, not to cover it up. Could you imagine if for just 1 week we saw the images of war? We saw the babies dead on the ground. We saw the women with their legs blown off by cluster bombs from Iraq to Afghanistan. We saw the soldiers dead and dying for just 1 week. Americans are a compassionate people. Canadians are a compassionate people. They would say no. War is not the answer to conflict in the 21st century. I see the media as a huge kitchen table that stretches across the globe, that we all sit around and debate and discuss the most important issues of the day, war and peace, life and death. And anything less than that is a disservice to the servicemen and women of our countries. They can't have these debates on military bases. They rely on us in civilian society to have the discussions that lead to the decisions about whether they live or die, about whether they kill or are killed. Anything less than that is a disservice to a democratic society. Democracy Now!